It is Tuesday, November 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the death toll from California wildfires now stands at 44 as hundreds remain missing. A new report says North Korea has 13 undeclared missile bases.
What we found were a network of missile operating bases located throughout North Korea.
And experts turn coal mines into carbon-ingesting forests. It's all ahead. At least 42 people have been killed in a wildfire raging in Northern California, making it the deadliest wildfire in the state's history. Authorities say hundreds more are unaccounted for 4 days after the so-called campfire swept over the town of Paradise. Two smaller fires in Southern California have killed two people. Forecasters warn the dry, windy conditions fueling the fires will be in place through at least Tuesday. Rainfall that could help firefighters gain momentum against the fires is not forecast for at least a week in either part of the state. California Governor Jerry Brown declared a state of emergency and asked for financial aid from the federal government in Washington. Meanwhile, the American Red Cross is playing an integral role in supporting the thousands of people impacted by the fires. International Edition's Lori London talks about the human impact of the devastation with Michael Dufilpierre's Red Cross communications officer, who is outside of Paradise, California.
We have dozens and dozens of volunteers on site. We have community partners there providing a safe place for people to stay. There's warm meals being served. There's supplies. There's different organizations there present, community and government partners, doing everything they can, we can, to help these residents who've been just absolutely devastated by this wildfire, these wildfires.
Are these people that have actually lost everything, that have lost their homes, or are they just displaced, or is it a variety of reasons why they're at the shelters?
It's all of the above. I've spoken to a lot of people who've lost everything and approach people to talk to them, see how they're doing, and they'll just open up, and you can tell they're holding back tears when they're explaining how they had to evacuate their home within minutes, gathered their belongings, their pets, and put them into their vehicle and just drove for their lives. The stories are harrowing, heartbreaking, showing me photos of their homes on fire or of what remains of their home. Mm. So you have a lot of people who have lost everything. You also have people who don't know if there's anything to go back to. Mm. And there's people worried about loved ones. So not only are they dealing with the loss of their home, they're dealing with the anxiety of not knowing if their loved one is alive. So the Red Cross, the community, local and national organizations are doing everything we can, everything they can to support these residents. They're going to have a long, difficult recovery.
When you were talking about the people not knowing where some of their loved ones are, is that because there are still people missing, or is it because the communications are not available?
There's still people missing. I don't have the specific numbers of missing people, but you know, at the shelter, at the entrance of the shelter that I was talking about at the Butte County Fairgrounds in Gridley, there's a big bulletin board with postings of individual that is looking for a loved one, phone number, message of love, message of hope, and it's heartbreaking.
Mm. How long do you expect people will need to be staying in Red Cross shelters, and how long does the Red Cross plan on being there?
The Red Cross is going to be here for as long as we need to. The Red Cross is present here locally. We've responded to disasters here on a daily basis, but we are here supporting the residents. Right now, the focus is on addressing the emergency needs, safe shelter, working with partners to provide food, supplies. We have trained volunteers to help provide emotional support. We have Red Cross nurses providing health support. So it's really right now it's addressing the emergency needs and doing so in these emergency shelters for as long as we need to. We have across the state of California, there are 18 Red Cross and community-managed shelters, providing safe shelter to about 2,100 people. At a lot of these locations, people are seeking overnight shelter, but there's a lot of people who may not necessarily need overnight shelter who are coming into these Red Cross locations to get a meal, to get some information, to talk with a Red Cross worker. So although there's 2,100 people who found safe shelter overnight at these locations, there's a lot more people who are taking advantage of the services that are available and the information that's available. Moving forward, this is going to be a long-term operation. Right now, we're in the emergency phase. It will transition to a recovery phase. So our assistance will move from emergency shelter to casework, working with people to connect them to the whole host of community resources that will be available. And actually, in between the two, there will be a time where we're going to be accompanying residents as they go back into their communities to pick up the pieces to see if their homes are still there. The Red Cross workers will accompany them. We'll be providing them with emergency supplies, cleanup supplies. We'll be going into these communities providing food. There are hundreds of Red Cross volunteers who have come into these communities to offer all these different types of support.
I would imagine some of the support would need to be just emotional support.
The emotional component is huge, especially when you're dealing with loss of life, large-scale loss of property. That's why we have volunteers here to address those emotional needs. We have a team of specialized trained volunteers. They're called mental health volunteers. These are mental health professionals who are trained and have extensive experience dealing with trauma. Right now, they're at the shelters. In the days to come, they're going to be accompanying these families, these residents, into these communities, because that's going to be a very difficult moment for the residents of Paradise and the surrounding area.
My understanding is there's nothing left of Paradise. How do they go back to a community where there is literally nothing left?
There's very little left, but at the same time, people will be going in to see what is left, to help pick through the remains of their home. There are some homes I have heard that are still standing. A gentleman that I spoke to who himself lost his home. He said several homes on his street completely destroyed, and then every couple homes you'd see a home standing without any damage at all. But yes, the majority of the structures, the buildings have been lost in the town of Paradise. I would also add the Red Cross has a resource called Safe and Well. It's an online resource for people to list themselves as safe. It also allows people to search for loved ones. We have Red Cross volunteers in the shelters that help people access it.
Red Cross Communications Officer Michael Dufault-Pouliers. He spoke to International Edition's Lori London. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The trial of drug kingpin El Chapo begins amid heavy security in New York. Amazon picks both New York City and Virginia for its second headquarters. The FBI reports the largest spike in hate crimes since 9/11. And CNN sues President Donald Trump to restore correspondent Jim Acosta his White House access. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists led by Johan Brox, an associate professor at the Australian National University, recently studied some fat molecules they had found on an ancient fossil. They say their studies provided evidence that allowed them to identify the fossil animal as a Dickinsonia and that it is the earliest known animal in the geological record. The scientists say the creature lived on Earth about 558 million years ago, which was about 20 million years before the so-called Cambrian explosion of modern animal life. Brox described this event as a time when complex animals and other life forms, like mollusks, worms, sponges, and arthropods, took over the fossil record. Brox and his colleagues described this primitive animal as being oval-shaped with rib-like structures along its body and measuring about 1.4 meters in length. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe discuss trade and North Korea ahead of APEC talks. A U.S. non-governmental group says it has identified at least 13 undeclared bases in North Korea capable of hiding missiles. The Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies said in a report issued Monday that its conclusions are based on commercial satellite imagery, interviews with North Korean defectors, and interviews with U.S. intelligence and government officials. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with one of the authors of the report. Joseph Bermudez is Senior Fellow for Imagery Analysis at the Beyond Parallel Program at SAIS, the Center for Strategic and International Security in Washington.
I would say that North Korea's ballistic missile threat and its nuclear threat, which would use the ballistic missiles as delivery system, remains very significant and has not changed in the past 10 years.
So what did you find?
What we found were a network of missile operating bases located throughout North Korea. Some of these facilities have been mentioned directly or indirectly over the years, but very few, if any, have been specifically located. What we did was we went in, we identified these, we disambiguated a great deal of information, we validated other information and negated additional information to come up with our listing of sites, and we'll be publishing additional reports going forward.
Where do we go from here? I mean, what is this enough, do you think, for the U.S. to change its position?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. The people who are doing the actual talking, both, you know, face-to-face and back-channel, are really intelligent people. They have a plan. I'm not privy to that plan. However, I want to make sure that the public understands what's actually out there so they can inform their policymakers, to inform those who are actually involved in the discussions. I think that's most important, that we have a base of information that is as valid as it can be at the unclassified level so that the discussion can be informed, so we can move forward in a realistic manner.
Does this show some insufficiency as far as U.S. intelligence is concerned, that they haven't come up with it, or do you think they have and they just haven't told us about it?
I believe that the U.S. intelligence community, along with its allies, have a very good understanding of North Korea's ballistic missile forces and their disposition. I would say that they probably don't have a perfect understanding. And that's why I want to see a full and verifiable list produced by the North Koreans to move forward with. North Korea is an incredibly challenging target when it comes to intelligence collection. And North Korea has, since the late 60s at least, if not further back, pursued this deliberate policy of trying to conceal or deceive its capabilities with nuclear, chemical, biological, and ballistic missile capability. If we don't recognize that, and if we don't push hard on that, they're going to allow us to believe what we want to believe, or allow us to settle for something that is insufficient in the long run.
Joseph Bermudez, Senior Fellow of the Center for Strategic and International Security. The report said the North Korean bases, which can be used to house ballistic missiles of various ranges, are well hidden, indicating the North's determination to conceal its military abilities. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence is in Japan Tuesday, meeting Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Pence urged the Japanese leader to cut his country's trade surplus with the U.S. and pressed for a bilateral trade agreement.
The United States has had a trade imbalance with Japan for too long. And American products and services too often face barriers to compete fairly in Japanese markets. It's for that reason that we welcome the steps that have been taken to address these issues over the past 2 years, beginning with the U.S.-Japan economic dialogue. But the best opportunity for free, fair, and reciprocal trade will come in a bilateral trade agreement. Mr. Prime Minister, we welcome the decision that you and President Trump reached in September to begin negotiations on a bilateral trade agreement.
The two countries agreed in September to begin negotiations next year. Pence is on an Asia swing that will take him to a meeting of regional powers in Singapore and the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting in Papua New Guinea in place of President Donald Trump. The Trump administration is considering imposing tariffs of up to 25% on imported cars and parts on national security grounds. Stephen Nagy is a senior associate professor in politics, and he tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, Japan is reluctant to enter a bilateral pact.
By and large, most of the issues that were a friction in terms of economic relations between the United States and Japan were solved in the 1980s. Second, I think we should recognize that even if we opened up the Japanese markets here, a lot of the goods being produced by the United States are just not in demand by the Japanese, for example, large vehicles. Much of the agricultural products are based on being produced in very, very large farms. The Japanese consumers are particular about what kinds of foods they're consuming, and they're really resistant to consume food products that are produced on mass scale. Third, and importantly, I think the Japanese think that the best way to deal with the deficit is to buy more American goods, to, for example, some agricultural products, but also military goods, as well as invest in the United States.
A bilateral free trade agreement is a non-starter in Japan?
I don't think it's a non-starter. I do think that there's a possibility of a free trade agreement if it embodies much of the rules and regulations and guidelines that were and agreements that were laid out in the initial TPP-11, in particular focusing on intellectual property rights, limitations for state-owned enterprises, and enhancing cooperation on the digital economy.
Countries including China, Japan, India, and the 10 members of the ASEAN group apparently are trying to forge a regional comprehensive economic partnership during a meeting in Singapore, and apparently the effort is going to be delayed until next year instead of an agreement reached by the end of this year. What is the problem there?
Well, I think there's several problems. First of all, on the Chinese side, the trade pressures from the United States is making them reconsider what is the direction that they should be doing moving forward in terms of trade policy in general. Second, there are challenges with one of the partners within the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement, in particular India. They're not known for their policies in terms of supporting free trade, and getting them on board means there's going to be important compromises from the Indian side. Three, the Chinese economy is slowing down, so they need to rethink what is the value of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership and how can it be altered so that they can reap more economic benefit from this kind of partnership.
Will the RCEP be an alternative to trade tensions with the United States?
No, I think the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership does offer some benefits for the partners within the region, in particular ASEAN and China. But the kinds of products that are being espoused or that will be traded through this kind of trade agreement really are low-value products that China does well, but they don't bring that economic boost, that adrenaline shot to your economy that a different kind of agreement would have. The tensions between the United States and China, not only shared between the United States and China, other countries such as Japan and other regions such as the EU also share many of the concerns that the United States have vis-a-vis China and its trade policies. So until those are adjusted, I don't think there's going to be a let-up pressure on China, and I don't think that China will be able to engage in other forms of free trade relations because of the imbalances that do come with China joining these large free trade agreements.
Stephen Nagy, he is at the Tokyo-based International Christian University. Meanwhile, in Singapore, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang Tuesday said Beijing hopes a code of conduct can be reached with Southeast Asia over the disputed South China Sea in 3 years, which he said could benefit free trade. He insisted his country does not seek hegemony or expansion. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Dramatic steps are needed to avoid potentially catastrophic levels of global warming, according to the latest report from the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Experts say nature provides some of the best ways to pull planet-warming carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Restoring forests is one route. In West Virginia, where strip mines have scarred the earth, experts are working to bring back the forest that once covered vast swaths of the Appalachian Mountains in the eastern U.S. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Deep within West Virginia's Monongahela National Forest lies a rare stand of virgin woods.
Living in the east, there's not many places that you can go and be untouched by man.
Shane Jones is a biologist with the U.S. Forest Service. He says a mapping mistake spared these trees when the surrounding forest was logged decades ago. That's good, because red spruce forests like this one excel at taking planet-warming carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and locking it away in the soil.
See all that organic material?
It's black because it's incredibly high in carbon.
The mountains of Appalachia have lost 90% of their red spruce forests to logging and coal mining. Burning that coal for energy is adding more and more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. As the planet warms, scientists say the need for forests to remove that CO2 is increasingly urgent. The University of Kentucky's Chris Barton says tropical rainforests get the most attention.
But here in the temperate region of the world, in Appalachia, 4 hours away from Washington, D.C., we have billions of trees that potentially we could be planting.
Where better, Barton says, than here on the remains of old strip mines? That's one reason Barton started a group called Green Forests Work, to put trees back on the roughly 400,000 hectares of Appalachian forests that have been strip mined away. But there's a problem with many of these lands.
If you went out and planted trees on these sites, they just didn't grow. The ground was way too, compacted. Water didn't infiltrate. Roots can't penetrate. Oxygen can't circulate in those environments.
The solution looks more like a Game of Thrones battleground than a forest in the making. Ripping up the compacted ground will let the trees they plant put down roots. Barton says it's not always easy to convince people it's a good idea.
We've had a lot of people kind of look at us twice. But it's the really interesting thing about it is after we do it, there's no question that that was the right thing to do.
They're starting to see results. Forests are coming back on the grounds they've ripped up and replanted. In West Virginia alone, restoring red spruce to its old habitat could lock up the equivalent of 56 million barrels of oil, scientists say. But not right away. It will take decades. Shane Jones says patience is key.
It's really awesome to see a tree planted 8 years ago that's now waist high. But at the end of the day, at the end of my day, we're barely getting started because our main goal with the restoration work that we do here is to basically take actions to then let nature take over.
Around the world, experts say, nature offers powerful tools to fight climate change. Nature works slowly, they say, but it works. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Elkins, West Virginia.
Thanks very much, Steve, and that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Take your pick, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Good evening.